And then somewhere down the line, you know, things happened to me. I hit rock bottom. My grandmother died. My best friend died. And then I became a monk. Then I find myself practicing psychotherapy. I love the hair. I wish I had hair like you guys. We can be the Three Musketeers.
Hey, man.
Listen, I appreciate it. Have you ever tried to grow your hair out, or is that against sort of practice for you as a monk?
No, I want that rock star kind of look. Gosh,
yeah, man.
I'm
you got the platform to be a rock star. You just got to let it grow for, I don't know, 2-3 years.
Listen, it's not all that being a celebrity monk. You know, no one exempts praise or blame. Trust me. They will praise me, and then they will blame, blah, blah, blah. So it's, you know, I think everyone out there always, you know, thought about what is it like being a celebrity? And I'm like, oh, if I could, you know, I have to inspire change or else we're going to have a very dangerous world. But, you know, but once I've done my 8 and hit the gate, listen, I can't wait to run back into the forest and sit underneath a tree.
So you talk about being a celebrity monk. I've never heard that term be used before. How do you contextualize that? What does that look like on the day to day? And as a person who is in celebrity status, how does that change your obligation?
I have a lot of, you know, people think that a monk has a very boring life, but not this monk. Again, the TikTok thing was an experiment. I just before talking to you guys, I was talking to a senior teacher in Poland. And she also wanted to know what I was up to. So now, you know, senior level teachers in the Buddhism world is reaching out and I'm capturing their attention. And I told them, like, my whole life is an experiment. I didn't mean any of this to happen. I'm just being me. I've never changed the way how I've taught. This is me. This is who I am. And so it blew up the way that it did. And now currently, you know, they asked me to write a book, which I wasn't ready. So I'm struggling to finish this book by October, according to the contract. But, you know, I wanted to be someone that is different, that makes himself available to the public where they can, you know, a lot of people have misconceptions about monk. They're like, oh my God, you talk. It's like, yeah, we talk. And so I wanted to make myself accessible to the public, given the rates of suicide and teen resiliency in schools. And I wanted them to know that this is someone that you can reach out and talk to about how to handle life's struggles. And, you know, my day-to-day life, most of it is actually answering calls and text messages about breakups and headaches and heartaches and stress and resiliency. So that's why that's the many phones that you see is for that. It's no different than the Dalai Lama. When he first started out, when everyone started to discover the Dalai Lama, he actually has dozens and dozens and dozens of monks with computers. Before laptops even came out, they were sitting there answering emails to people across the world dealing with suffering. So, you know, it is what it is. I got myself into this mess, and now I just got to keep it going. And I have assistants that, you know, help out with media, and it's working. It's working. I'm learning to adjust to it. Yeah, it's very rewarding. I would never give this up for anything. Out of all the jobs that I've had in my life, this is the most rewarding. And this is part of living the good life.
Let's talk a little bit more about doing this at scale, because I think this is the interesting part. When you start off, you grow slowly, slowly. You get the few hundred followers, maybe a few thousand. You can sustain that on an individual level. You're now at a point where you have an audience of over 1 million. How many people are reaching out? You know, is your line constantly buzzing? And how are you going about reaching those needs? How big is your team? How are you thinking about approaching, you know, your philosophy at scale to the masses?
There's 1,000 direct students that is under my guidance, supervision, and you know, me giving them instructions. The phone calls, I get about 50 phone calls a week on follow-ups. That meaning when I give my recommendations, they're supposed to do their homework and let me know how they're doing, if they're journaling, if they're studying CBT, if they're going on my YouTube, if they're catching up, studying the Four Noble Truths and the basics in Buddhism and how it applies to their life, what it means to them. So each student is given the same recommendation based on where they're at. So yeah, it's a massive scale, but the amount that will actually enter the stream of enlightenment, the amount that will actually liberate themselves, because this requires human effort. The Buddha was proof that a human can in fact achieve full enlightenment, can transcend their suffering. But you don't do it with praying. You don't do it with asking God for stuff. You do it by and through your own effort, human effort. I mean, if you threw a stick down the lake right now and you ask Buddha, it's like, hey, dear Buddha, can you send some angels go down there and get it for me? And Buddha like, listen, dude, you go down and you get it yourself. I've been measuring my students on a scientific level to see who is most likely going to graduate, who is most likely going to turn out how I project them to turn out. But it's tough. You know, you have students that will fall off the swing from time to time, will have all sorts of issues in their life, breakups and mom and dad and running away, using drugs, and they'll relapse. So it's a constant measuring of the scale of people, you know. And I think all of us are just trying the best that we can. And it's my job, like Joey said earlier, that every time when he got on there, it was wow, thank you for saying that. It's because it's a constant reminding people, because that's our job as humans, is to forget, actually. It's no wonder why this great man named the Buddha came along the way and started reminding people. It was like, hey, what is mindfulness? It's remember to remind yourself how your mind is, you know, remember to catch yourself and how your mind is jumping, to observe. Remember to observe how your mind is jumping. So it's a still working progress, and they will change when they're sick and tired of being sick and tired of wherever they're at, whatever it is that they're doing.
It's interesting because you seem to be an educator to the masses, and with mass exposure comes a lot of potential for mental risk, or sometimes even physical risk, putting yourself out there on a platform which is relatively the unknown. As people who are on TikTok posting their first video, seems like you're shooting in the dark, and one night something just happens and you blow up and you may become the next Charli D'Amelio. I'm wondering, how has your mental fortitude changed over the process of growing on TikTok? It must require some form of mental resiliency. So I'm just curious if you could touch on that.
I studied counseling psychology at Eckerd College for 4 years and preparing to be a psychologist. And you know, I was all excited until Crystal, who, because I dropped out of college at SPC, St. Pete College. It was horrific. We had a professor that was like 100 years old. I thought the classroom was a funeral home waiting to happen. Really. So I dropped out after 6 months, and then Crystal persuaded me to go back to college. And I was all excited becoming a psychologist because I thought that I was going to be bulletproof to human emotions, human cognition, and human behavior. And Crystal one day told me, you understand that being a doctor of happiness, they're coming to you because they're not happy, right? And it hit me really hard that day. And I was like, that's what's waiting in store. What's waiting in store is a whole book of ICD-10 and DSM-5 diagnosis of mental health disorders. And then somewhere down the line, you know, things happened to me. I hit rock bottom. My grandmother died. My best friend died. And then I became a monk. And then all of a sudden, I go forth and I said, hey, if you're dealing with this, you can call me. Then I find myself practicing psychotherapy. You know, and it's like, oh my God. So it was very mentally taxing, very emotionally. It was a big burden because I was learning how to adjust and how to not carry on the weight of the people, their pain and suffering, because I was one of those very empath type of person, sensitive type of person. I mean, right? That's what most of us actually are. That's what makes humanity right, is that the sense that we care, and some of us care a lot. That was me. And so there were times where I'm holding a one-on-one session, and I actually like passed out on the floor because I was so exhausted trying to keep my mind and, you know, the mind and body correlation with stress and cortisol levels and just fatigue and just trying to handle the masses of suffering. And I passed out, and that was when I told myself multiple times, and I said, you need to take a break. You need to cheat out. You're And then you see me in the hospital a lot in 2018, 2019, I think a little bit of 2020. It started to decrease in frequency, as evident on Facebook Timeline Live. And even I was in the ER with the IV stuck in me. I was still teaching. I still took these phones and put it right in front of me. And, you know, trying to drifting in and out of consciousness, drifting in and out and trying to fake it till you make it and trying to let the world see that I'm fine. Let's move on with these teachings. You know, now there's a whole library of teachings. Now I'm a lot more skillful at it. Now I hold them responsible for what they're doing or not doing. So yeah, it's a lot of fun, and I know what it's like to be a therapist and how they get burned out. Yeah, because I was burned out multiple times. as to date, you know, I think out of the thousands of messages, only probably less than five is unanswered because of the appropriation of the questions. And all of them have been answered within a 24-hour timeline.
Wow.
I will attest to in front of Congress under penalty of perjury.
It's almost like a IT hotline for happiness. It sounds like what you're running. Sounds like it's quite the rat race. But also, I have a deep fascination for your why. Why work so hard? Why put yourself in such a position of potential mental, emotional, and physical distress?
You're right. I was a previous interpreter serving all areas of law and all areas of medicine. I've already burnt out leading up to my downward spiral as a, you know, as a 20-something year old. When I started spiraling out, I was like, what, 25 years old? So I was already exhausted working in the field of law and medicine and seeing death and dying and criminal. And of course, they didn't teach us how. They just trained us at the Supreme Court how to do our job, which is, as an interpreter, you're just a machine. Words in, words out. Not the emotional attachments that you have with certain cases of, you know, crimes against children, crimes against the elderly, and so on. And so, but this is what defines a human as a man who came, who conquered, and who subsequently left, is that, you know, I have the capacity to handle the masses of crowd of suffering. It is a challenge. How easy is it? How easy for me to just run into the woods and just sit there and meditate and taste nirvana again? I've tasted it once for 4 hours, and I really like it. And I really like, matter of fact, previously if you saw me meditating, I just stopped giving guided meditation because I was really enjoying my peace. And that's easy, right? That's easy being self-centered, monk. It's easy thinking about your own enlightenment and neglecting the masses of crowd. I couldn't do that. It's not in me. And so, again, this is what I think that this is what will define my legacy when I leave in the next 50, 60 years or so, is that there was this one great monk that came along and he cared so much about humanity. And these were the evidence that we have that he provided so much as he could in times of need, in times of destitute, in times of depression, economic turmoil, in times of war. And so, you're getting the dings. We're gonna get a lot of these dings. So hopefully not. You know, and you look at all of the great people historically, look at how much they've done for humanity. And obviously the word lazy cannot be used to describe them. Simply put, all of the great presidents worked tirelessly, CEOs. So now as a monk, as long as I have energy and health, I'm going to keep on giving, because that's what the Buddha wanted us to do. Give more and take less. True joy lies in that. You know, versus the total opposite. And I've challenged the whole world. I said, you know, even when I was a CEO, I gave more and took less. My whole life was giving historically. And I've challenged the world. I said, find someone out there that says, Chi Dao took more and gave less, I will leave the country. I will disappear.
It's a fascinating story, especially your relationship to you know, your religion and your culture, because, you know, after hitting rock bottom, correct me if I'm wrong, you found Buddhism as a means to sort of heal those wounds. For me, I've always really struggled with my religion and my culture. I come from a Jewish background, and it's something that historically I've not been very proud of, because it's something that I've really had to really try and reconcile with, is the idea that, you know, there was adversity, there was trauma in my, you know, cultural background, and I wanted to escape it, right? And it's something which I'm still actively working on at this current moment. But when looking at you and the content that you've produced and the narrative which you've pushed to the world, you seem to present a level of comfort and grace in your religious and cultural identity. How have you gone about developing that?
Buddhism is so chill. It's such an inclusive and chill philosophy. It doesn't discriminate anybody for any reason. Even if you are a murderer right now, it's okay. You can still join us. There was this story of Angulimala who killed hundreds of people and wanted to kill the Buddha, and the Buddha, you know, inspired him to change and become a fully enlightened being. And so it's a message of forgiveness, is a message that you can in fact change no matter where you're at in life. And again, finding the middle way and everyone's definition of the middle way and bringing that to the people. The Buddha made it very easy for us monks to expound his teachings and spread his teachings. And we don't have to try so hard to get followers, because we can lead by and through our own examples, by and through his own methods of that he laid for us. And that's what I've done. I mean, you know, I think people see that inspiring millions, is that they can see it, they can feel it in their hearts, they can see it through their eyes and their heart, through the nature and tone of voice, manner, style, disposition. You know, I mean, how many people can you actually fool? I mean, look at all of us. When we profile people, when we like analyzing people who are making these pitches in religion or spirituality or whatever, and some people, you look across the screen and you're like, oh my God, he's really sketchy. And some people, you're like, wow, oh my God, this person did in fact do their homework. And spirituality means knowing deep down inside who you are, where you've been, where you are now, where you want to go, and who you want to go with. And for the one who actually did their work, you can see it. For the one who actually meditated, you can see it. And you have never met them before in your life, and you can just tell that this, there's something about this person, that there's substance to this person. So yeah, I've been meditating for 21 years now. Though when I first started out, I just trusted the process, just sit and just follow instructions. Didn't even know what Buddhism was all about. I just wanted to follow instructions carefully. And it wasn't until, you know, 7-8 years ago where I started really diving deep at the analytical and psychological part of Buddhism to like understand the point. So technically, all of that time, you know, like 13 of those years were just sit and just do what they ask you to do, which is meditate and just focus on the breath. And then the last 8 years was like really honing in to just the deep teachings of the Dhamma. And again, that's what the world saw. And this is what they're witnessing right in front of them, is that someone who practices very diligently. And once the aha moment took place, I realized, oh my goodness, I have to tell people about this. I have to lead people into this path, because number one, it's free. You know, smoking weed every day is going to cost you money. The cocaine and addiction is going to cost you a lot of money. In hope of what? What kind of happiness are you chasing using these substances and drugs and sex and gambling? And here I am discovering that you can in fact achieve true inner happiness, actually knowing who you are, actually okay with who you are. And after that, nothing really matters. It doesn't matter how people view you, what you think people think of you anymore, the judgment and all that, because you're already secure in the knowledge of who you are. And so, you know, that's what I brought to the table a couple years ago to social media. And again, hoping to inspire by and through my own change.
I love that. I want to dive a little bit deeper into a period that might be somewhat difficult to discuss. So, of course, you know, speak at will as you wish. But I'd first like to start that sort of discussion with, when was your first introduction to the teachings of the Buddha? And then how did you feel about it initially?
Well, historically, there's a picture in my phone that showed my grandma and myself at a temple, and we have to wear this gray uniform. And growing up, you know, I've always been exposed to the monastery, even though I was raised Catholic, right? And baptized and all of that good stuff, and went to Catholic schools. And that's how I was able to keep the native tongue, and that's how I was able to be well so versed in the Bible, the teachings of Jesus Christ. But, you know, there is something about the monasteries and the temple that is so warm. You walk in there and you realize no one's judging you. You just feel no one's judging you. It's, again, it's so chill and it's so calm. And you just sit there and you realize, oh, my goodness, I'm right at home. Even though it's the temple. It's not yours. But when you walk in there, there's something about closeness to peace. How do you define peace? What is peace? Peace is free from disturbing emotions. And every time when I walked into a temple, I was free from worries. Literally, it was like walking into heaven, where you're just there with God. You know, if you were Catholic or Christian, you would say, yeah, I'm there with God. It feels like I'm there with the angels. As a Buddhist, I would describe it as being there and fully in the moment. So one could say that this is kind of like nirvana. It's like, wow. And then it amplifies the experience when monks come in and you're like, oh, here comes the Jedis. And then all five of them sit there and they actually turn around. They face the Buddha. They don't even face you. And then you're like, oh, okay, good. Well, they're not looking at me because my makeup's obviously not on. And then they start chanting and it's like, wow, the vibrational, the frequency and just the effects of it puts you really in the moment of what it is. And again, like for half my life, not realizing what they were doing, the rituals, the rites, the signs and symbols that they were doing, but how I felt about it. It was a place that was indescribable. It was a place that I didn't really know the meaning to it, but I feel right at home. And yeah, I hope that answers that.
Mm. Yeah, it certainly does. And there goes the phones. Oh. no troubles at all. So the reason I started with, you know, this might be sort of a difficult part to discuss is I want to dive deeper into when you rediscover or maybe even discover the true meaning of, you know, the teachings of the Buddha, which sounds like it comes from this period of deep pain.
Ah, okay, got it.
And so I would be curious, you know, what did it feel like, you know, losing those people so close to you? How did it feel to be at the bottom? Basically, and then when was the moment that you come to realize, wait, there's another way?
In 2015, my grandmother passed away right in front of me due to a heart attack right here at Northside Hospital. I was very quite attached to her because she was the one who introduced me to Buddhism. And again, she inspired me by and through her own peace. And so is her mom, which is my great-great-grandmother. That woman was so zen. And so when that morning, when all of this unfolded and I took her to the hospital and her vitals were fine, I'm like, you're fine. And my grandmother said, listen, I don't want to lose you. And I'm like, you crazy. Your vitals are fine. We're going to be out here in like half an hour. What are you talking about? She knew she was dying. She knew that it was coming. How? I don't know. And when that heart attack took place in that room in the ER, my eyes were like, I mean, the ER doctor stood in front of me. She even froze up. So I took the first action of running towards my grandmother and ripping her shirt apart. And I'm like, get the zapping machine in here. And that's when they're like, okay, everyone out. And they pushed me out. So they worked on her. And it was comical the way how her heart was playing with doctors. They brought her back. And then she coded. And they brought her back. And then she coded. And then this was like back and forth for like 20 times. And I'm like the whole, you can only imagine the family's response to this. And then finally the doctor came back and the doctor says, listen, even if we did bring her back at this point, she would have brain damage because of all of the loss of oxygen at this point. So you guys want to unplug? I said, yeah, let's unplug. He didn't even make it back to the room and she's already made her choice. So I had to hold it together. I coordinated all of the funerals and everything else. And then probably like a week later is when it started to sink in, when I realized she wasn't around, and it started to spiral down, down deep. I started to take suicidal actions. Everything that I was doing was geared towards the suicidal path. And had I not changed, I would have wound up in prison or I don't know, in the hospital, right? And then a year later, my best friend passed away, Jacob Hall, due to an accident. And he was also a brother that I've never had. And wow, it really sucks having to deal with two deaths a year apart, because it takes years for a human to heal according to the stages of grief and mourning. And mind you, this is in my senior year of college, so my senior year for my bachelor's, and it's really stressful. It's really stressful. The 4 years in college alone with the existent of ADHD, right? Existent of the never stopping, ever going depression and anxiety of a teen. We all have been through that, you know? So I was just, I've had it. And I told myself, like, I can't handle this anymore. One of the reasons that kept me alive was knowing that I was an interpreter and that people were depending on me, and I was the only one, perhaps in the state, that can serve all areas of law and medicine. So I realized if I took my life, and I had a gun at the time, I had a Glock 17 9mm at the time, and I was playing with it every night, and I was like, oh, look, and I would hold it up to my head, and I would hold it underneath my chin, and I'm like, what's the best way? I don't want a closed casket. I would really entertain how to like do this. And I realized, well, you know, if you take your life, what about your patients? And at the time, I had a lot of cancer cases. And so I realized, I'm like, dang it, you can't take your life now. You got to work until these guys are done, then take your life, because then it would not be a selfish act. So I ordained, and it was the first time me having to stop, because I could never sit still, and, you know, it's just ADHD bouncing across the room, the walls, always keeping busy, running away from the pain. When I ordained, I met my wonderful teacher, Venerable Duc Minh. And it was the first time where it was like, stop. And it's the first basic principle in Buddhism is to stop, stop. Stop what? Stop thinking, stop doing, just sit, relax, clear your mind. And I wanted then, when all that took place, the question becomes, why is this pain there? Why the depth and magnitude of this pain? And how did I get here? How did I get to being so suicidal and so volatile and so angry? And I started asking questions and tracing back. And this is the practice of dependent origination, which is the links of trying to see the links of influence in your life, the causes and conditions in your life. So I started tracing backwards. It took me a whole year to do that. And it started with by writing. It started with just writing down a chronological timeline of, as young as I could remember, hey, you remember immigrating to America at age 7? Let's write that down. And I charted it out, right? My timeline, who I met, who I was with, where I fell in love, where I fell out of love, how I didn't get along with my mom, and so on and so on. And I saw all of the pieces of the puzzles together. And I realized, oh my goodness, I know who I am now. I know how I got here. So the meaning of spirituality started to come together. Then I meditated, right? And I meditated in Gainesville. And in 2017, on or around November, October-ish area, from 11 to 2, I was forcing my breath. I don't know why. You're not supposed to do that. But I just took really, really deep breath, and I closed my eyes. And then all of a sudden, I lost sensation of my body, couldn't feel my body anymore. And I went to this place, and you can describe it kind of like the skies at night, you know, little stars, little dots. And I knew I was there. And that was amazing. It lasted for about 3 to 4 human hours, but in that realm was only 20 minutes. And I described that as a taste of nibbana, a taste of nirvana in Sanskrit. And that was, whoa. And I was hooked, and I realized the methods worked. It's our job as monks to prove the Buddha wrong. It's all of our job to prove the Buddha wrong from a scientific standpoint. He wanted us to do that. In the Kalama Sutta, he says, don't even believe me. Your job is to try out my methods and see if it works out for you. If it works out, great, have at it. If it doesn't, you're free to choose any other philosophy or religion you like. And the fact that I have tested it for myself, have tasted that, that's the coming together, and then it's just diligent practice there after that, just constant, that led to today's results.
I love how you reference meditation as being integral in your process of self-discovery, much like you. I think, although I'm less experienced with meditation, I'm really trying to immerse into that world and focus on the breath. But for a lot of us listening, meditation is just that, just sitting with your eyes closed and focusing on the breath. But it seems as though you've applied the idea of meditation and mindfulness into every aspect of your life through your practices of Buddhism and your ability to convey thought and action. My question is, how do we take that leap from meditation, just being a singular act, into a way of living?
Well, the type of meditation that I deployed and employed, used, you know, Theravada Buddhism can get a little analytical and psychological. It was my job to kind of disseminate. It was my job to kind of make it simple for everyone to understand. That's why it led to the millions of people that loved it. It was because it was easy to understand. You read some of these Nikaya books and you're like, oh my God, this is such a headache. You ever listen to other monks, you know, like talk about the stages of enlightenment or the Four Noble Truths? It's just like a headache. It's just like, this is too much right now. Like, I'm already dealing with a breakup and I can't really analyze what you're trying to say. So the first, now when I teach meditation, the first thing is to try to cut back on the drama in your or your life. Because no matter what meditation methods that you want to use, it's really hard to sit there in silence and trying to investigate your mind when you're, you know, when you have baby mama drama, when you have breakups, when you have stuff going on, you know, with your boss, with your coworker, with your neighbor, feuding, suing, whatever the case may be, legal problems, financial problems. So the first thing in our practice is the gift of safety. The gift of safety is for yourself and for other people by keeping the precept. Don't cheat, don't lie, don't kill, don't steal. You know, the basic stuff. Same thing like the Ten Commandments. And once you're able to cut back on the drama, and looking at the blueprint and details of your life, you kind of clear the way for quiet time. And trying to enjoy quiet time, it's a wonderful thing through everyday activity. Meditation can be applied by and through washing the dishes, vacuuming, washing the car, cleaning your room, folding your clothes. These are activities that, you know, that is very meditative, because you're in the moment of just doing it and just enjoying it and learning how to apply that as a habit every day. You know, then once you know, you kind of taste that a little bit, then we can go into really looking at the other stuff part of you. But stopping, calming, breathing are some of the basic things to do. But again, you know, you can't do that if there's a lot of stuff going on in your life and trying to rearrange your life, rearrange things, compartmentalizing effectively and strategically, trying to handle homework and work schedule and taking care of the baby, picking up and and so on. You know, it helps drawing all of that out. Everyone's life is moving 100 miles an hour, especially in America.
I want to talk a little bit more about the 100 miles an hour in America, because I think it is a unique phenomenon of sort of the capitalist work-centered culture we live in. It's almost as if you're fighting an uphill battle with the teachings of the Buddha. And so what I'd be curious about is, what have you noticed to be the most potent lesson that you impart to your students? What has been the common thread for most of them to have their realization that they have to go countercultural as opposed to maintaining systems of pain and suffering?
Nothing lasts forever, which is the central teaching of impermanence, anicca, right? And then when you apply that to everyday life, in anything that you do, in anything that you have, in anything that you will have, you realize it doesn't last forever. The boat that you have is not going to last forever. The girlfriend, boyfriend that you have is not going to last forever. You know, the phone that you have is not going to last forever. The feelings that you have, not going to last forever. The thoughts that you have, not going to last forever. As fast as they arise, as fast as they will leave, as long as we don't attach onto them, and so on. And this is how you deal with things in life effectively, realizing that they're not going to last forever. If you know, it's like seeing this helps you see the true nature of reality of life and the true nature of reality of anything, actually. Let's take a girl, for example, or a guy, interchangeable. You know, it's like, what is it with the boyfriend? What is it with the girlfriend? Well, the three marks of existence. She's not going to last forever. It's not always satisfying being with him or her. And rarely are they under our control. But the first thing was, they don't last forever, right? So knowing these three marks of existence, also known as anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, suffering, and the non-self, what's the point of attaching? What's a point of wanting things to be different rather than accepting it for what it is? It is what it is, and it can't be what it ain't. You know, it's the easiest way to remember. And so if we, you know, were to, that would be the potent teaching that I would use for everyone at any time in life, you know.
I think an added dimension to a lot of what you're describing is a level as well of cross-religious, cross-cultural, cross-belief and lifestyle dialogue. How do you go about talking to people who have very harsh and entrenched mindsets?
They have people with really stiff mindsets. You know, this is my beliefs, these are my values, this is what I know, this is what I care about, and everything else they, you know, want to refute and dismiss, easily dismiss, without consideration of evidence, without consideration of scientific methods. It's simple. I mean, I would ask, you know, I would listen to them first and foremost. Compassion arises out of deep understanding, and part of deep understanding is deep listening skills. And once you listen to them, whatever their rigidly held beliefs or values or principles are, I would respond like the Buddha would. And the Buddha would say, "Well, yeah, Tom. Well, yeah, George. How's that working out for you?" And it's a reflective question, right? Is that, you know, like, I believe abortion is blank. I believe Democrats are. I believe Republicans are, right? Okay, and so people hang on. You can see the agitation. You can see the facial features and the grouchiness and the arr. And you just ask, how is that working out for you? And you have to ask them kind of like, yeah, so, I mean, are you at peace right now? Right? And you define peace for them, which is free from disturbing emotions. And obviously, they are a body of evidence themselves. As soon as they started talking, it's a body of evidence in front of you. And it will reveal to you that they're not at peace because they have attached onto these worldly issues and affairs. So that's how we get people to, that's how I get people to, you know, kind of rethink about things and try to adopt a more flexible mindset and to see the reality of how it doesn't, it's not conducive, and how it really doesn't relate to one's own immediate suffering right now, right? Are we depressed? Are we anxious? Are we, what's going on with us right now? And is holding on to these idea, concepts, and beliefs really alleviate this hurt and pain deep down inside, the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? Or are we hanging on to these concepts and beliefs and standing up for something just to mask what is empty deep down inside, to mask the pain or the void or so on and so on? So, you know, the conversation can get deep, you know, if they have the respect and if they have the courtesy and consideration of having a conversation with a monk or with me.
Yeah. One thing that you're describing super well is this intentional lifestyle, intentional discussion, which I think is missing a lot from our cross-cultural, cross, you know, political dialogue. Ironically, though, I think sometimes the hardest people to talk to are the ones who are 1, 2, 5, 10% away from where you are. And as this relates to you, how do you go about having those discussions with other Buddhists who may interpret the word of the Buddha differently? And, you know, maybe an example of a time where you've had a disagreement with another Buddhist.
Luckily, I've never had to. Well, actually, I did once with a Mahayana monk on something. But we inspire by and through our own change. Why are we here? Why are we here with this person? Who is this person? One must ask. Because whoever you're with and whoever you're talking to, there's a reason why you're with them. There's a reason why we're talking here. And so when you remain actually nobly silent on certain subjects, trust me, they will have a conversation with themselves. The wise do not argue with fools. We try to skillfully make our point, skillfully. It's not what you say, it's how you say it. And the rhetoric has to be really, again, skillful and timely. It falls under right speech in the Noble Eightfold Path of Buddhism. Is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? Is it beneficial? And is the timing of this conversation right now on this subject and matter at hand? And so, when it comes, obviously we ask for evidence. It's a very scientific approach. And we ask, well, how do you back this up? And how does this relate? And how is this beneficial for you? And how is this beneficial for me? Again, it falls under those elements and guidelines that the Buddha have already set forth for us. So if any monks, monastic or non-monastic, raises an issue that is debatable, raises an issue that is of question, then, you know, we apply these same set guidelines and try to move about them cordially down the list to get to the fact and matter at hand. I sit on a panel of Buddhist scholars, and there was one time where they grabbed like the most senior in the world sitting with us, like Bhikkhu Bodhi, and one of the venerable said the subject was the honor around the dates of one of the Buddhist holidays. And in my mind, I was just like, what? We're here debating on a date of a Buddhist holiday with the most senior monks here? Don't we have other stuff to discuss about, like world peace and how to like bridge people together or something? But I was a junior monk. I still am a junior monk in that panel, so I just remain humbly quiet and just nobly silent and just, okay, well, at this moment, I think that the Buddha want me to exercise patience and tolerance and endurance and not wise to just, you know, but yeah, it's, so some of these things you have to approach skillfully using Buddhist principles.
We've talked about the concept of nirvana a handful of times throughout this conversation. And just to sort of clarify it for those who might have never experienced it, I personally don't think I ever have. What did nirvana feel like? And you mentioned that you've only experienced it once. What have you done to try and reascend to that plane?
Thank you. That was a very good question. I think, is most of your audience a young audience?
Yep. Between 18 and 25.
Oh, okay. So yesterday I did, oh my God, someone's going to call me out for this. Someone's going to call me out for this. But yesterday I did enlightenment and rolling a blunt. Rolling a fat blunt. I did it on TikTok. And it hit like boom right away. Now, mind you that every time when I select something in my mind and holding the phone and doing a 60-second video, it needs to be correct and right and within consistent with the teachings of the Buddha, and it just needs to be right. And I need to be able to like justify that in front of a grand jury. The jury of Buddhist scholars, the jury of everybody, okay? So I said, you know, the only time you guys are enlightened, I said, there's a lot of you that smoke out there, and the only time that you're actually enlightened is when you're rolling that blunt, are you not? And some of you roll it so well, you have a reputation. And they all got a good kick out of that because, yeah, a lot of people smoke. I don't. I have never smoked. But I have watched my students do it, and I'm just like, well, look at them. They're just like, they do the licky-licky thing, and they like rolly-rolly-rolly thing, and they're like really in the moment. They're like laser beam. It's like they're doing like brain surgery. It's like watching a surgeon going at it, and I'm just like, wow. And then they rejoice once it's like so beautiful and long, and they're like, ha, 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 and then they pass it around. You know, I got that million followers right after making the gaming and enlightenment video also, where I said, the only time you are enlightened is when you're playing video games, especially first-person shooters. And, you know, when you're playing video games, you know, when someone's, like, shooting at you, you're just like, oh, you're freaking out. You're reloading and you're, like, popping people and you're not thinking about the past. You're not thinking about the future. You're in the moment of that game. So that is one description, easiest to understand. Is nirvana, enlightenment, interchangeable? Is that you're in the present moment. And right now you guys are pretty in the moment to me, with me, and I'm in the moment with you, especially your hair. I still can't get over this hair. And you always got this black hair. I thought you guys were like musicians or like, so, yeah, I thought you got celebrities. I was like, oh my God, I'm talking to like Los Angeles, LA right now. Joey looks like $1 million right in front of me. So, you know, we're in the moment with each other, with the conversations and every word that we're saying and the meaning behind these words. We're not thinking about the past or the future. Imagine that if I'm thinking about, like, you know, like my exes or my past breakups, and then you're asking me a question. I'm like, oh, well, I'm sorry. Can you say that again? Okay. I was obviously not in the moment there. So these are, you know, things that I help people to understand, again, when you're washing the dishes. Are you washing the dishes or are you somewhere else? Some of us wash the dishes and we're like, gotta pay bills, gotta pick up little Joey. I gotta buy her flowers. Oh my God, did I even put like air in my tires? I think the left one is like deflated. And how easy it is to access enlightenment. Even though it's a little ordinary and even though it's dry in the beginning, you know, you're washing the dishes and you're like, oh, what this... dishes obviously squeaky clean. Wow. But I want everyone to also reflect on the relationships that you've had with people in the past and how in the moment you actually really were with them. I reflected this yesterday with Jacob, now that we just spoke about him, and I realized that I didn't even know he was there until we started working together. Jacob came into my life like 007. He came from Brad's crew and Brad and Jacob's crew. And he was just really quiet, introvert. And he was just kind of there, and I didn't realize that he was just there. I had to go back to my pictures. We're like, oh my God, that's Jacob. Did I talk to him? What happened? I was not in the moment in those times, and I regret that. I regret that. Had I known about enlightenment or some monk tell me this right now, I could have like stopped. Have a conversation with Jacob, had more time with him, and not regret it until present day. So now when we think about previous relationships, again, when you were with your boyfriend, girlfriend, grandma, mom, dad, sister, auntie, baby mama, whatever, Were you in the moment with them when you were at the movie theaters, when you were sitting there and enjoying time together at the lake fishing? Or were you on your phone looking at girls on Instagram? Or were you looking at your stock market and see if it's dipping or it's rising? And the Buddha says if you're not in the present moment, you're as good as dead. That is so true because you're with this person, but you're not with this person. Ah,
Yeah.
so that is not enlightenment. It's this moment is not very enlightening, right? One could say. The other definition of enlightenment is that, letting everything go. Letting go of greed, anger, and ignorance, foolishness, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, which gets more psychological and analytical from a Buddhist standpoint. But for now, all of the, because you just told me the amount of viewers and their ages. Right now, just take it easy and learn to walk, walking meditation. Learn to kiss the earth with your feet. Learn to stop and smell the flowers. And we also have the selfie thing, right? Where kids like to like grab their phone, take pictures, and some of them, right? You're like, hello? Are you gonna take it or what? But they're actually aperture and exposure and black and white and like filters, and they're like really in the moment of trying to put you in the middle of the screen. So that's their enlightenment. That's your enlightenment right there and then. You're not thinking about anything else but how to perfect this moment of this picture. Now you apply this to working, to school. You're in the moment of your assignments. It's you're less likely to make a mistake. You're more likely to get better grades. You're in the moment of a lecture. You're going to get the most out of the lecture, paying $2,000 for a class, becoming the best nurse that you're going to be, the best lawyer that you're going to be, the best police officer that you're going to be. We look at the effects
I
of
think your mic
mindfulness.
is
We
cutting
look
out
at
a
the
little
effects
bit.
of
Sorry,
more.
yeah. I don't know if you're tapping on the mic, but can't hear you that well. Sorry. Yeah, okay, now we're good.
Where did I left?
Whether you're a
Where did I
police officer,
left?
be the best nurse that you can be. Sorry about that. I just wanted to make sure the audio is there.
Yeah, I was playing with
No worries.
the thing, with the laptop. So, how we look at when we're in the moment and enjoying in the moment, how effective we can be as a son, a daughter, a worker, a student, a boyfriend, a lover, a husband, a wife. And yes, there's such thing called mindfulness sex. There's mindfulness eating, mindfulness sex, mindfulness practices. Is you apply all these activities we humans do, and apply mindfulness to it, and it just increases the quality of your life and the quality of the interactions between you and other human beings. And once you try that, once you've tasted that, you realize, wow, that I am fully living. I am fully in this moment. And don't wait until a picture is taken and then years down the road, you're like, I don't really remember what happened that day, but that was a nice picture. So enlightenment is that. I hope that clears that up as most basic and easy to understand as much as possible. Oh, and by the way, I
Definitely.
think I neglected part of your question is that nowadays when I sit and I meditate, again, I hone into nature. I sit and listen to, I use the one-pointed concentration technique to grab like the sound of the wind, the crashing waves of the ocean, sound of a bird, to connect my mind with nature and nature with my mind. And in those moments, I am not thinking about the past, the future, nothing. It's very quiet, and I really enjoy that quiet. And I would call this nibbanic moment. Peace also fleets. There is impermanence in peace. Even the Buddha says, don't even cling on and attach on to peace because it too is subject to change. But we want more peaceful moments in our lives, do we not? And that's something that I really enjoy, is closing my eyes again and breathing.
Definitely. I want to close out with two final questions. They're a little bit more rapid fire. The first of which is, what's something that you've recently changed your mind on?
Buddhism Without Border. I had a program that I created called Buddhism Without Border, where I get very socially charged in social subjects. Pride Month just passed in June, and I was very outspoken, standing up for the LGBTQIA plus community. But then I wanted, and then the Roe versus Wade abortion, and a lot of people asked about that, and I have decided to strategically not address that directly. I have decided not to address the Supreme Court decision. And again, I'm going to return back to the noble silence, because I think that it is very emotionally charged subjects right now. And I think that people would probably not benefit that much from what I'm trying to say, because of how emotional involvement systemically everyone is involved in it, that they cannot probably think objectively. There's too much subjective stuff in there right now. That's something that I'm going to back off a little bit with the social stance and issues, and citing the fact that the prime minister in Japan just got shot, and that the subject was delusional, thinking that he was associated with a hospital and there's poverty. And I realized the dangers of stepping into Buddhism Without Borders and certain things that I'm doing. People could misconstrue or take sides or think that I'm the enemy, and being a religious figure and sometimes wearing orange robes would make me a perfect target to get sniped. So that's something I have changed my mind on, and I realize if you want to live long and inspire more people, maybe it's time to back off on certain programs that you've created.
Definitely. And lastly, what is giving you hope in the world right now?
My hope is that what gives me hope is that everyone can change. I know that it can happen overnight. I've seen it. And to our listeners, you can change. You can change the way how you think. You can change the way how you feel, thus leading to better choices, more wiser and kinder choices to you, your neighbors, your friends, your family. And if you adopt the methods of the Buddha, you will see your life change slowly, gradually. And you can measure your own progress. I mean, again, don't even believe me. And even if I was the Buddha himself, a Buddha, again, you're not to take any of my words for just based on blind faith and confidence. You are to test out everything that I have said today, and you are to test out the teachings of the Buddha. And again, that's, you know, people are like, well, does God exist? Who cares if he does or does not exist? Have you ever wondered that you yourself is a God? You know, every one of us here is a God. What does that mean? Well, look at Hitler. That man was God when he did what he did, and he decimated all those humans. You know, he had the power to take life. Well, and so is all of you, especially here in America. Everyone has the power to exercise Second Amendment and grab a gun, for example, you know, or a knife or whatever. Again, then you can play God anytime, any day of the week. So, again, when we adopt the teachings of the Buddha, we become wiser and kinder, creating a safer world, giving the gift of safety. If you have nothing to give at all, the best you can do is the gift of safety, which is sila. And I think everyone can live in harmony, have a better world, you know, a less anxious world that we have now, you know, a less divisive world, if we can learn how to talk to each other, how to be less, less polarized, the divisiveness. And again, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. And Buddhism teaches you how to communicate with other humans effectively, with the existence of their values, beliefs, principles, and the causes and conditions that causes them to be how difficult they are. People who are difficult to love actually need it the most. And we can teach you how to love these difficult people, and that is what will make you beautiful in the end.
Beautiful words from the Venerable Tree Dao. Thanks so much for coming on the show. How can people plug into your work?
You can find me on YouTube, Tridao Monk, Tridao Monk. And you can also put the same thing on Google, Instagram, Ven_TRI_DAO I mean, I'm across all of them, so except Twitter. That's too much. There's other stuff out there that's a little too much. I try to keep it simple and a unifying platform for everyone to come together as a community to share these types of topics and issues with all of you. I really thank Asher and Joey for having me on the show. You guys are awesome. I didn't know what you guys were going to ask, and I really liked the way how you asked it. Some leaves have never been asked before, and really enjoy it. And hopefully down the road, you know, if you want me to come back and to touch up on any subject and issues in the world, you know, let's have for at sure. it.
I certainly think that there's a future that exists where you come back, and really do appreciate you again.